Hey, I'm Ben Stiller.
I'm Adam Scott.
And we make a TV show called Severance. Severance is back for season 2 on Apple TV+.
Before the premiere, Ben and I are going to be binging season 1 and putting out daily recaps. And after that, we're going to keep going as we recap every episode of season 2.
The Severance podcast with Ben Stiller and Adam Scott is presented by State Farm. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Listen and follow now on Apple Podcasts, the Odyssey app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
There's one thing that will forever change the way you sleep, and it's the softest, 100% organic cotton sheets from Boll & Branch. You'll fall asleep faster, wrapped in the most luxurious comfort. You'll never sleep hot again with sheets that feel breathable to sleep in. You'll experience the purest softness on night one and feel your sheets get even softer with every wash. Discover the difference with 15% off your first set of sheets at bollandbranch.com with code ODYSSEY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Do you believe you are wrongfully terminated for speaking up against your employer? Wilshire Law Firm isn't afraid to go up against corporate giants and will protect you every step of the way. Get justice and feel safe. Call the experts at Wilshire Law Firm at 1-800-800-3333.
971 FM Talk Podcast.
The NTSB just had a news conference, going to have the very latest on that. And then we have a retired pilot who's going to join us, Alan Campbell, who has written a book called My Life Above the Clouds, has flown in dozens of times to that airport. And we'll have some insight from him coming up. Still a lot of questions that we don't know the answer to. I have some interesting audio that I have not shared from Jamie Reed, who was the whistleblower at Washington U and Children's Hospital that I'll get to. And then we're going to talk about paddle a little bit later. Pickleball is huge across this country.
Well, oh, yeah.
Paddle is a game that's really been taking off in Australia and in Europe. And Cliff Marsland, you'll like this because Cliff is the director of rackets and he's an assistant GM at this place called Paddle and Pickle. But he's also got an Australian accent. So he's automatically cool just with the accent, right?
I already love it.
It does. I told him that when I met him. I'm like, Cliff, it doesn't even matter what you say because people just be enamored by the accent, right?
That's right.
It's kind of like listening to Dave Murray, the sultry, dulcet tones of Dave Murray.
Yeah, that's right.
I feel bad because
I have an accent.
We always call you into service when things are disastrous here. And by the way, we still do have some ice and snow, despite all the rain yesterday, on the ground. But we got a really nice stretch of weather coming up, don't we?
We do. Before we get to that, though, what is paddle?
Thank you. That's what we're going to find out.
We are, but here's the best way, and I saw the courts. So it's a combination of pickleball, racquetball, squash, and tennis, and you can play the ball off the walls. That's what makes it different, but the court is smaller like pickleball, and that's basically all I know because I saw these courts a few weeks ago. I don't know a whole lot about it.
Are they raised courts? Are they off the ground?
No. I don't think so.
I've seen what you're talking about, Dave, because that's another thing.
Tennis.
Yes. Yeah. There's something else that's like that.
Oh, they're going to keep inventing these games.
All I can tell you, this is not a sales point at all, but the orthopedic surgeons that I know love pickleball because it has increased their business big time.
Well, I was on the IR earlier this week with a back injury myself, so I believe that wholeheartedly. All right, what are we looking at weather-wise here, not only the weekend but into next week, Dave?
Yeah, it's kind of a 50-50 weekend as far as temperatures. The whole weekend looks. Except it's a little chilly tomorrow.
Uh-oh, we're losing him. Hang on one second. Let's see if this clears up. We may have to have you repeat that last 20 seconds. Everything was fine until then. All right, let's try again. Dave, you there?
All right, how's that?
Yeah, try it again.
Okay. You know, Saturday is chilly. Let's just go with that. Sunday, a chilly start, but it is winter. Beautiful Sunday afternoon. 64 degrees. That's the warmest we've been since the middle of December. Still nice on Monday. Next shot of rain, and it's an all-rain situation. Developing on Wednesday night and into Thursday. So there's no big cold in sight. There's no snow. There's no ice in sight.
Okay. Well, you know what? Sue, what do you think?
It's not good.
Dave, we may have to let you go. It's just not working. I heard most of that.
Yeah, I did. I got most of it.
But unfortunately,
Dave, if you're still there, I met a big fan of yours today at Roland Collision on Kings Highway, and they fixed my car, and they're awesome. But they wanted to say they listened to the Dave Murray, and they want to know when you're on with the what the season will be forecast because they only trust you.
Oh, all right. There we go. Do you have an answer to that?
Mm-hmm. Well, let's see. The next one will be spring. And that will be some in late February.
All right.
We'll look forward to that. You're cutting in a little bit in and out, so we'll let you go. But, Dave, thank you so much for the forecast. Basically, what he said is Sunday is going to be really nice in the afternoon.
Wow.
And tomorrow, just a little chilly. And next week, the beginning of next week, looks pretty good as well. So I still have, you know, a fair amount of snow and ice on some parts of my house. And you can tell where the sun's getting to it and where it's not. So it was – we got a lot of rain yesterday, though, but that stuff is still hanging out there. All right, so one thing that I want to point out before we get to some things related to the crash is – And I didn't talk about this on the roundtable, but the Post-Dispatch has since written a piece about this that's posted online. So the rumor was, and a lot of people were getting messages, ICE is cracking down locally on a lot of this stuff, right? They're conducting raids. Well, there's partial truth to that. They're not conducting raids. So what happened was, is at the El Magway restaurant that is in O'Fallon, which I think is right off I-70, if I'm not mistaken. I think you can see it there, but there's maybe multiple locations. Police were called for a drug raid is what I'm told. And then immigration officers detained some of the workers because of, you know, questions about citizenship. So they were there not to raid El Magway for, you know, illegal migrants. They were there for some other reason. But when you come across people, maybe this is the difference in law enforcement. When you come across people who are not documented, who are illegal, they're going to do something about it. So that's what happened. So you're going to see a lot of this panic out there, what's happening with ICE. But you should know that that's what's happening. All right. On the crash front, the NTSB just held a news conference.
We know that there was a significant incident in which the two aircraft collided. A pretty significant fireball. If you will recall, even after the first day, we only had maybe one or two grainy images that were coming out. We're seeing more and more at this time. So we're still collecting data, but we are not going to opine until we see a lot of other things.
So there's been a lot of different video, and it's even more horrifying because you can see how much time that helicopter was heading right toward that airplane. On the questions of staffing.
The FAA's had a very robust plan in looking at staffing. Obviously, we'll be looking at not only staffing that day, but progressively staffing. How many people, what job functions they were doing, were they being combined, were they not? What was the weather outside? What was the number of landings? I recall back during COVID, one runway was being used, runway one, that was the only one. 33, as traffic came back, started being opened up. So we would look at changes in traffic patterns, construction at the airport, all of that. It all paints a very big picture.
So they also talked about some of the cockpit recordings. Now, they have the black boxes, which is good.
We've received a lot of different information on ATC, and so I'm going to I'm just going to preempt it. Off-the-shelf software programs are not always as accurate as the data we specifically get from ADS-B, from the black boxes. All of that are factors that come into our investigation. So we will not speculate about ATC tapes that you may have heard and seen online or snippets. We are getting the full cooperation that we need to be able to make an accurate assessment and to make sure what we are saying is factual and that it will help and aid in the entire investigation.
Well, that poor guy was nervous as hell, right? You could hear it in his voice. He was not handling that moment very well. A lot of questions. So some of this stuff needs to be defined a little bit. We have Lieutenant Colonel Alan Bullitt Campbell, U.S. Air Force, retired. He was an airplane captain with Delta for 37 years. He's written a book called My Life Above the Clouds. Lieutenant Campbell, how are you this afternoon?
I'm doing well. These interviews are a little bit depressing. It's a sad situation, but otherwise I'm doing well.
It's awful. You know, the thing that I can't get away from, and maybe this is the wrong place to focus right now, these people who have to dive into that river and recover these bodies. And you go home on the weekend, and that's what you're left with. And the families, all the devastation, it's just awful.
Well, there's so much we don't know, and that's one of the best examples of it is the people that have to deal with that. That water is cold. They're in the water. Even if you're just on the boat, it's still a very cold place. And then today it was supposed to be rainy.
Yeah. Hey, let's go through some of the definitions. When they're talking about the ATC tapes, can you help us with that? What do they mean by that?
Well, pretty much everything's on a tape, all the conversations, that sort of thing, so that if there's an accident, they can go back on the tapes and say, okay, who said what? When did they say it? What was the timing? So I think that's just a standard operation. You know, everything on the airplane is taped, and then everything with air traffic control is also taped. So that gives them an awful lot of evidence to look at to try to put this puzzle back together.
So what do you think happened here? What's your best explanation? Obviously, there's still a lot of questions that need to be answered, but what's your impression? We've seen a lot of the videos that have emerged in the last couple of days, different viewpoints. What are your thoughts?
Well, my thought is that American Airlines was asked to use a different runway, which is just efficient. There's no problem with that. Runway 33, he has to go up the Potomac a little further. He has to go a little bit more to the east to make that left turn. But everything looked fine to me in that perspective. The problem was with the Black Hawk, they were supposed to be going down the other east edge of the Potomac River, and they were supposed to be down at 200 feet. Had they been there, we wouldn't even be talking about this. That they were further into the body of water, a little bit west, and that they were higher, almost 400 feet, that's unexplainable. That should have never happened. They should have not been there. So that's the big puzzle that they're going to have to put together is why were they there?
Mm. Let me read this. I've been all over X, formerly Twitter, and a couple of people have asked questions, and they asked pilots to weigh in. And this was a Black Hawk guy who claimed to be a Black Hawk pilot. So this is what he said. I'll describe to you what I think happened. Imagine you're looking, or not what happened, but how, a pilot might react to some of the things. He goes, imagine you're looking at the world through toilet paper tubes, and everything is just different shades of green and black with stars and ground lights hard to differentiate and aircraft lights that look the same as those. Then you have three different radio frequencies going off in your ears. Then you're trying to navigate without any peripheral vision. Then you're trying to keep the aircraft under control, and you're trying to keep watch for all traffic, not just one plane, because there are several in the sky at once, and you're trying to mentally keep track of all of them. And you get distracted for like 5 seconds, or your focus goes elsewhere. And like you, your instructor pilot asks you a question about airspace regulations. Boom, you're all dead. Flying those machines is really tough, and the airspace and the NVGs make it a heck of a lot tougher. Is that a pretty good analysis from a Black Hawk?
I think that was a very good analysis that just tells you the story that only he would understand. The rest of us really don't understand that. But then when you add to it that they were wearing night vision goggles, why in the world are they doing that? If you're out in off down the road somewhere, then you put on the night vision goggles and you do your training. But when you're going by Ronald Reagan Airport down the Potomac River, you shouldn't have had those things on. There's lights everywhere. It's not a darkness situation. You're not in combat. So that's going to be the huge explanation is, were they wearing them? Were both pilots wearing them? And then why were they wearing them?
Did you see the staffing shortages are real, and there's been reporting about the New York Times, Washington Post, and elsewhere. And I did see something earlier that said that they typically maybe make an adjustment after 9:30 because there's not as much traffic at the airport, but that a supervisor made a call in this instance, allegedly, to combine some of the efforts with the air traffic controllers earlier than 9:30. Do you know anything about that?
No, I really don't. They've got their own rules and work schedule and things like that. I understood that there were supposed to be two controllers, but one controller needs to go to the restroom, or he's going to go get coffee, or it's time for him to go eat. Then they probably do a little temporary one-on, one-off. But I just did read something on the news that said one of them had asked to leave early, and therefore apparently did leave early.
Right. Yeah, that was what some of the reporting in the Washington Post was. Do you think that, not that they could have done anything, but do you think that the pilots of the airplanes saw the chopper at all?
Well, that's something that a lot of people don't really understand, but those commercial airplanes have that warning system in them on their little displays up in front, and it shows all the traffic around them, which comes through the transponders. And so they'll know if an airplane is over to their right, it'll tell them the altitude, 500 above you or whatever, but it'll be just really quiet because it's not a threat. If it becomes a threat, then it'll go yellow and it'll just pop up and give them more attention, but it might have an altitude difference or whatever. If it's going to be a problem, then it'll go red and it'll actually talk to them. It'll say pull up or go down or whatever, and it'll give them instruction. It's just a recommendation. It's not a force. But then when you consider that airplane is gear down, flaps down, speed slow, 300, 400 feet above the ground, it doesn't have that many options.
Right.
It can only go left and maybe up, but at that speed, it couldn't do either one aggressively. So if it had a symbol of an immediate collision potential, there's just not a whole lot it could have done.
The other thing we're learning here, and this is what makes things even more frustrating, is that they had a near miss at that airport just the day before.
Exactly. And that's, of course, that's coming right out on the news. There were a couple of different airplanes that did go-arounds because of helicopter interference. And they just showed something on news a few minutes ago. A guy was in an airplane, a passenger, and he was doing a video out the window. And he showed the two helicopters going right along the east side of the Potomac River in formation. So that's exactly what they do. But, of course, there was altitude separation. It wasn't dangerous. But it just shows you what the setup is.
Let me. This is new reporting, and this may have come after the NTSB news conference. But bear with me here, Alan, because Washington Post just cleared this story. They say air traffic controllers twice alerted the crew of a U.S. Army helicopter to the presence of an inbound American Airlines jet, with the first warning issued 2 minutes before the aircraft collided Wednesday night. Radio transmissions show. How could that be 2 minutes? That's incredible, isn't it? And now I've raised the question, like, have we ruled out this possibly being a suicide mission?
Well, that's something they'll certainly look at. I wouldn't rule it out, because they're going to look at, was it, you know, a combat mission? Was somebody trying to destroy it? Was there a bomb on board? They're going to go through all of that. But my assumption is, with some of this data, is that the helicopter was given that information, and they looked out and they saw an airplane, but it might have been the airplane behind this airplane. Yeah. And so you've got to know the sequence. You've got to know who's the closest, who are they really talking about. And if you make an assumption of the wrong airplane, well, that can be devastating,
and I think
that may be the answer.
Yeah, I think it might be the answer. So the story also says this, along those lines. They were looking at the radio transmissions. The quality is kind of hard to hear the audio recordings, but they say that, this is the Washington Post, aviation experts who reviewed the communications said that a member of the Black Hawk helicopter crew responded each time from the tower by saying that he could see the plane and requested visual separation, meaning the copter crew would maintain a safe distance each time the request was approved. Well, there's really only two answers then. Either it was a suicide mission, or they were focused on another plane.
And I would say B.
Yeah,
I would say they were focused
agree.
On
yeah.
another airplane. They didn't see the one that was close, and it was just a huge mistake.
Should there ever be, I mean, they've now suspended helicopters around that airport. Shouldn't that be maybe permanent, or are there too many training exercises that go out of that area?
Well, they were talking about that on the news also. And, you know, my assumption would be, yes, they should suspend those airplanes. You know, when you think about all these airports around the country, you can't fly within 2 miles of LaGuardia. You can't fly within 2 miles of the Atlanta airport or Los Angeles. Why in the world can you fly that close to Ronald Reagan? So they're making a huge mistake there by allowing helicopters to fly through there for training. Now, if it's a security issue, if it's an emergency issue, if there's been a capital something going on and they've got to scramble up there and take care of it, then that would be different. But to have helicopters flying at 200 feet low level down the river, that's probably going to change. And I would say that would be the fix. The commercial airplanes have to have their radius. They're big, their flaps and gear down, they're limited in maneuverability.
Right.
So you've got to move the helicopters. And a lot of people don't realize that helicopter, if he'd have seen a collision, he could have diverted or he could have just stopped. You know, they can hover. So they could have held him up and said, okay, hold your position, let the commercial airplane go by, okay, continue. So there were a lot of options that just weren't used.
Well, I hope we get some answers. Lieutenant Colonel Alan Bullitt Campbell, who has written a book about his life as a pilot, My Life Above the Clouds. Lieutenant Campbell, thank you so much. This was extremely helpful. We really appreciate the perspective this afternoon.
Great. Thank you.
All right. Take care. That's interesting. That I'm glad that I opened up the iPad there, because, and some of that, by the way, may have come from that news conference, and we aired some of the audio, but I was on the air. I didn't hear, you know, the entire thing. But
the night goggles is...
doesn't make any sense.
I don't.
Right? I heard someone address that yesterday, because that area is so lit up. Have you ever had night vision goggles on?
Just, I've seen pictures of how it looks when you're looking through them, and all you could, he's right, it's all lit up through there.
If you have night vision goggles on with all the lights around you, it would be more distracting. Right. So that is a big question mark. We'll see if we get some answers to that. We'll take a break. 5:25. We're coming back with more. I have some really interesting audio from Kansas and our whistleblower, Jamie Reed, WashU Children's Hospital, on the, you know, gender-affirming care issue coming up.
Head to Safeway this week for these amazing deals for their members. This week, it's all about buy five and get five free when you buy 10 mix and match participating items. Here are just a few. Coca-Cola, 7-Up, Pepsi, or Smartwater beverages of various sizes. 16-count fresh baked cookies and pint-sized Ben & Jerry's ice cream, as well as 6 mega or 12 double rolls of Signature Select soft and strong bath tissue and 6 rolls of Brightly paper towels selected varieties. Visit Safeway.com for more details. See you in the aisles.
Hey, I'm Josh Fink, owner of Knicks Menswear. Getting married? Don't rent some random suit. At Knicks, we help you own the look for about the same price as a rental. You're marrying the love of your life. Don't you deserve a suit that's yours forever? Knicks Menswear, your friend in style.
College holds a mythic place in American culture, but there are stories you won't hear on the campus tours.
The higher-ups are concerned about one thing, and that is avoiding scandal.
I'm Margot Gray. On the new podcast, Campus Files, we cover everything from rigged admissions to the drama of Greek life and student protests. Listen to and follow Campus Files, an Odyssey original podcast, available now on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, usually I keep things relatively light on a Friday evening. I'm going to divert from that plan here just a little bit. And obviously, we were talking about the plane crash. I am going to talk about this game of paddle. You know, pickleball is huge, but there's this new game called paddle. I don't think it's exactly brand new, but it's really taken off. So Cliff Marsland's going to join us. He's the director of rackets and assistant GM at Paddle and Pickle. And it's off of Olive soon. The way that Cliff, I met him a couple weeks ago when I was playing pickleball with my dear friend Jeff Drew. And Cliff described paddle, P-A-D-E-L, as sort of a mixture between squash, tennis, pickleball, and racquetball. You can play and you can play it off the walls, right? So he'll explain all this to us here. We will lighten the load at the end of the hour. Plus, I have audio cut of the day. But Abigail Schreier, who is, she's the partner of Barry Weiss, who started the Free Press at thefp.com, where really the only real journalism is taking place on the Free Press these days, or maybe on Substack. Abigail Schreier has been simply one of the heroes in this gender-affirming care nonsense movement, along with Riley Gaines and, you know, our friend Billboard Chris up in Canada. But Abigail wrote this piece yesterday, and I'm going to play some audio, too, from Jamie Reed, who is our whistleblower from here, because she was in front of the legislature in Kansas a couple of days ago testifying about some of this stuff. But this piece in the Free Press is quite something. She said, when the history of the 21st century gender mania is written, it should include this signal entry. In 2020, a website called GoFundMe, usually a place to find disaster relief appeals and charities for starving children, contained more than 30,000 urgent appeals from young women seeking to remove their perfectly healthy breasts. Why is it that I'm just reading that now, by the way? There's a question for journalists out there. Another entry from June of 2020, the New England Journal of Medicine, America's platinum medical publication, right? We got a couple of doctors, maybe some of you smart physicians at WashU who worked with some of these people who abused children. They published a piece explaining that biological sex is actually assigned at birth by a doctor and not a verifiable fact based on our gametes stamped into every one of our cells. In fact, biological sex ought to be deleted from our birth certificates, the authors claimed, because a person's biological sex serves no clinical utility. Breaking news to gynecologists, of course. Public schools began asking elementary kids whether they might like to identify as genderqueer or non-binary. I have a friend whose daughter is about to be married. And when she was 17 years old, I remember him telling me, yeah, she identifies as queer. Well, I mean, she wasn't. She's straight as can be, but it was the cool thing, right? So public schools were asking kids, are you genderqueer or non-binary? And any dissent from this gender movement was met with suppression. The ACLU and their most prominent lawyer, Charles Strangio, announced his intention to suppress irreversible damage. That was Abigail's book. Well, it was a book-length investigation into the sudden spike in gender and transgender identification among teen girls. Stopping the circulation of this book and these ideas is 100% a hill I will die on, he said. Weeks later, Amazon deleted Ryan Anderson's book criticizing the transgender medical industry. She says, I could go on, but as of January 28, 2025, I don't have to. On that day, President Donald Trump signed an executive order announcing that the federal government would no longer fund, sponsor, promote, assist, or support the so-called transition of a child from one sex to another, and that it would rigorously enforce all laws that prohibit or limit these destructive and life-altering procedures. And by the way, the other thing that he did today, And I'm so happy he did it. And I wonder how Michelle Lee, who likes to virtue signal at KSDK on her Twitter page, I can't follow her anymore because she blocked me. She's a she, her. It was confusing because her name was Michelle, so I didn't know. And I noticed that on the KSDK site, the virtue signaling. But Trump also banned amongst the federal workforce any use of pronouns in emails. Sorry, I root that on and I love it because it's a bunch of nonsense. Abigail Schreier says, to the practitioners and promoters here in St. Louis, by the way, let's send this message to WashU and Children's Hospital. To you promoters and numberless devotees of pediatric gender-affirming care, a.k.a. child abuse, a euphemism, she says, a euphemism for the vast apparatus pushing junk science on vulnerable children, it came as a much-needed slap in the face. If it seems odd that the spell of pediatric gender medicine should have been ended by politicians and not physicians, consider that in America, politics is how it began. And this is where it gets interesting. She talks about Obamacare. This is where you need journalism, right? Abigail Schreier's doing some here. Section 1557 of the Affordable Care Act, President Barack Obama's signature legislation incentivizing and coercing private insurers to offer their products on a government exchange, prohibited those companies from discriminating on the basis of sex. And in May of 2016, 6 years after the bill was signed, the Obama administration's Department of Health and Human Services added this fateful qualification. Discrimination on the basis of sex was to include discrimination on the basis of gender identity. Obama effectively wrote into law through health care that gender identity is a protected class. So she quotes in this piece a healthcare executive and gender medicine researcher that says that this opened a huge new source of funding for these treatments. Where do you think WashU got their money, right? From us, from the taxpayers. Because once these insurers feel like they have to cover it, that's it. You just have to turn on the engine. And if an insurer covers testosterone to treat a man who is deficient, then according to gender ideology's cracked logic, the insurer would also need to cover testosterone for a woman identifying as a man. If a procedure to remove a man's unwanted breast tissue was covered, then a similar procedure for a woman identifying as a man must also be covered. Denying those claims could subject insurers to federal enforcement action. So Abigail says to mandate coverage for gender treatments, activists snuck in gender identity without even Congress voting for it. Transgender rights groups filed lawsuits to test whether judges agreed. Suddenly a woman was anyone who claimed to be one as far as provision of health care was concerned. Luxury cosmetic treatments became available even to minors covered by their parents' insurance at fire sale prices. Now, she said, when puberty blockers have never received FDA approval to treat gender dysphoria in youth, doctors could prescribe them off-label as long as they had reason to believe that they would be helpful to parents and patients. Everywhere physicians looked, activists and medical accrediting organizations and every news outlet of legacy media assured them as if one voice, these were life-saving treatments. Oh, these kids will commit suicide. They'll be dead if we don't cut their breasts off and give them hormones that are going to change their bodies forever. Remember WPATH, the World Professional Association for Transgender Health, an activist organization styled as a medical one, issued guidelines used as the standards of care by all major insurers and Medicaid to justify all this nonsense. I'm paraphrasing a little bit here to get through this piece. It was nonsense. And the Biden administration pressed onward. They sued states that enacted bans on medical transition for minors. Rachel Levine, Assistant Secretary for Health, good riddance, a transgender adult, successfully pressured WPATH to drop minimum age requirements for gender medical treatments and surgeries. That was in September of 2022. And again, President Joe Biden and his embarrassing vice president used the bully pulpit to assure transgender Americans, especially the young people, that your president has your back. It's a bunch of nonsense. And guess what? It's over. Trump has put the kibosh on it. Now let me go to Jamie Reid, because if you're still confused as to why the kibosh needed to be put on this nonsense, this child abuse, she explains it pretty well. And you don't have to believe me. I'm a conservative, right? I'm an evil Nazi, according to the liberals. Well, she ain't.
I worked in pediatric gender medicine for nearly 5 years, and I was once a true believer. What I learned is that these are interventions based on poor research, poor evidence, and poor outcomes. Last week alone, two new systematic reviews were published in Canada, finding that puberty blockers and cross-sex hormones have zero to no evidence to support their use. Last night in Queensland, Australia, puberty blockers were banned for those under the age of 18. In the center where I worked, I saw directly the patients who were harmed by these interventions, patients whose mental health got worse after initiation, and patients who mourned the permanent changes to their bodies.
Yeah, and where she worked was right here in St. Louis at WashU and Children's Hospital.
This all started with a small group of clinicians in the Netherlands who came up with this idea to transition kids. They were seeking the children they believed would go on to have a lifetime of troubles with their sex and intervene when they were young. Why? Because the transsexuals' adults that they were working with were not doing well. When they completed the first study, they found that the young people were proto-gay youth. 68 out of 70 self-proclaimed that they were same-sex attracted, and they transitioned them.
That is not a close number. Think about that. 68 of 70 were gay. They were just gay, and they hopped them up on puberty blockers.
And then we in America caught wind, and we cast a huge net across this entire country in every state, and we pulled in whoever could be caught. And now we see this problem. We see the proto-gay youth, the vulnerable, the children with autism, with mental health concerns, with trauma, and they have all been caught in this new group. And now there's a group of primarily girls influenced by TikTok, hurt by COVID lockdowns. These are straight girls with private insurance, with caring liberal parents, and we have transitioned them all. The social contagion is real.
Yes.
And now the problem is clear.
Yes.
The girls began to realize what had been done to them. They stepped up and said, stop, this is hurting us. And we now see the global crisis for what it is, and it needs to be stopped everywhere.
Now, listen, if Trump was not in the White House right now, this crap would still be going on. This is such an important election. I think a lot of us knew that. But the only thing missing, in my opinion, at this point are prison terms for people that worked on this stuff at WashU Children's Hospital in other cities, too, because it was child abuse. It's disgusting what happened, and I'm so glad it's stopping. All right, Sue, you know, occasionally I try my hands at pickleball. I'm not, by any stretch of the imagination, Frank Cusimano.
Oh, I love the pickleball.
Frank is a pro, though, and Monique, his wife, man, they're good. But I went out to this place called Paddle and Pickle a couple of weeks ago.
And when you say paddle, it's E-L?
P-A-D-E-L.
Okay.
And I was unfamiliar with it. And then I remember that you had talked about it on the show at one point. You were describing it. So I met Cliff Marsland, who is the director of rackets and assistant GM at Paddle and Pickle, which is off of Olive. Is it technically, Cliff, how are you? Is it in Olivette, technically? Is that where you are?
Hi, Mark. How are you?
Good.
Yes, we are in Olivet. Yeah, that's where the club's located, on North Price Avenue.
Cliff is from southern Missouri, as you can understand the accent. Sounds like perhaps the boot heel. No, you're from Australia, right?
Correct. Yeah, I'm from Perth, Western Australia originally, but I've lived in the U.S. for 15 years.
I told you a couple weeks ago, like, when you're on the air with us, what you say from now on doesn't really matter because we're just all enamored with the accent, even the listeners. They're not even listening to what you say, Cliff, but you just have to know that. But look, I'm very fascinated about a paddle, this game, because what you told me that night was that pickleball is, like, huge, taking over America, but paddle is a game that's really been hot in Australia and Europe, correct?
Correct. Yeah, Padel is,
Padel.
Well, in the U.S., yeah. Well, you can say any way you want.
Okay.
But Marcos Del Pilar, who's, you know, considered as one of the leaders in the coaching world of Padel, has actually come out and said you should pronounce Padel because there's another sport called platform tennis that is colloquially known as Padel.
Exactly.
P-A-D-D-L-E.
Yes.
So it's a big, yeah, it's a little confusing, but Padel, you know, what the sport we're talking about here is actually comes from that sport. It's a fantastic sport, cross between tennis, squash, racquetball. You can play off the wall, fast upswing, kind of like pickleball. It's growing in popularity around the world faster than any other sport. And I just got recent statistics that there's 30 million people playing worldwide right now.
So, are the courts, describe the court size and how the walls kind of work. Is it the same size as a pickleball court or bigger?
It's actually a little bit bigger. It's somewhere between the size of a pickleball court and a tennis court. So in the metric system, it's 20 by 10 meters. But in the Imperial, it is 32 feet by 65 feet, roughly.
So is it a situation where you don't have a ceiling, though, like in racquetball, right? There's no ceiling shots?
No, we have an indoor facility over here at Padel and Pickle in Olivet. If you hit the ball and it hits the ceiling, the ball would be out. But it's a sport like tennis or pickleball that can be played inside or outside. The court's enclosed by a glass and wire wall. At the back, it's 4 meters high, and on the sides, it's 3 meters high. And you can, like I said before, you can play off the wall. The rackets are a little shorter than tennis, a little longer than pickleball. So the sweet spot is closer to your hand, therefore it's easier. As someone who's coached four different racket sports, I can tell you that the upswing is more forgiving because of that sweet spot distance between, the distance between the sweet spot and your hand. So the hand-eye upswing is much easier in that respect versus the tennis, where people run into the ball more when they're starting out. That's probably the biggest challenge I would see with beginner tennis players versus beginner padel or pickleball players.
I have so many questions. Okay, but let me start with this, because I play tennis and pickleball, but playing off the wall eludes me. So if someone were to hit it to my side, can I hit it on my side to the wall and then over the net? You see what I'm asking?
No, I get it. That's a good question.
Yeah. No, absolutely, you can. And they borrow some terminology, I believe, from racquetball and squash, where it's called a boast. So you can hit it into the glass, but you cannot hit it into the side wire and then send it over. You would lose the point there. But you can boast the ball into the back glass wall and then send it over the net, or into the side glass wall. So, yeah, those shots kind of produce some oohs and ahs. So, if you've got people watching, it's kind of the Hollywood shot. I like to call it the side boast. So, yeah, it's pretty cool.
Hey, Cliff, I should ask this from the beginning, but what's the consistency of the actual ball?
So the ball is a smaller tennis ball. It's pretty much the same thing, but it's 89% of the pressure when it comes straight out of the can. So it's a little softer, doesn't bounce as high, a little more forgiving again. So you can see how it's like mirroring a lot of the factors that make pickleball, have that easy upswing. Padel also has an easy upswing, but I would say it's probably a little harder to master because of the wall and the length of rallies and the technical progression of the sport. But that's kind of, as you get into it, you discover that on your journey.
So Cliff is he's the director of rackets and assistant GM at Padel and Pickle. Now I've learned how to pronounce it correctly, Cliff Marsland. How much is it taking off here in St. Louis? Because there are limited courts. I'm not asking you to promote other courts because you want to talk about your courts, but how much is it taking off here in St. Louis?
It's flying. I mean, we have probably around 250 people at the club already playing padel. I heard of there's one other private court in the St. Louis County area, but that's it. We're the only place that is publicly accessible. And yeah, it's growing fast. We have a league on Thursday nights that's full. It sells out, 4 or 5 weeks before we even start it. Courts are booked up all weekend. A lot of the evening times are getting booked up fast. Like, people are, it's really catching on, and it is mirroring what's happening elsewhere in the world. When the sport started to really boom, in the late 80s and early 90s, and then into the early 2000s when the Spanish Federation formed a professional tour.
Oh, nice.
Hey,
awesome.
I've got another question, you guys. I'm sorry.
I'm just intrigued by this.
Is the scoring more like pickleball, or is it more like tennis? In other words, do you have to do, are you serving number one, number two, that whole deal, if it's doubles?
Great question. It's actually exactly the same as tennis. So it's rally scoring based upon sometimes tennis is described like an analog clock, 15, 30, 40 game. I don't know why it's 40 and not 45.
Right.
I'm not sure with the story about that. But, yeah, you go to deuce, you play sets to six typically, tiebreak at six all, best of three. Professional padel and then club level padel also adopts the golden point rule, where if it goes to deuce, you'll play a sudden death or, winner takes the game next point. It's called no ad scoring in college tennis. So it's a great way to kind of like keep the scoreboard moving, and it's really good for, folks that are, trying to get their game done in, an hour, hour and a half. And, we're all a little time poor out here. So it's convenient like that, where it has flexible scoring.
Hey, so in padel, do you have that goofy scoring thing where you have to do, I still don't get this with pickleball. It's like 0-1, 0-2, the whole person serving. Is that padel as well?
He said tennis.
No, No, there's different. You call the service score and then the receiver score, but there's no serve order or serve number like in pickleball. So it's just the two numbers.
I like it better already, Cliff. I like it better already. I think that's awesome. Well, I'm going to try to get over there. Our mutual friend Jeff Drew, a.k.a. The King, is asking me, I can't believe what he asks of me and the things that I do for him. He says, while you have Cliff on the air, tell him to book under my name plus two Cusimanos, one Reardon, 8 o'clock at court 8, 7:30 next Wednesday night. So that's your order from Jeff Drew. How about that?
I'll get it done. Sounds good.
All right. Hey, this was fascinating. I want to learn more about this game. I think it's really cool. Yeah. And since I play racquetball and I love pickleball, I think it might be, I'm not going to say I'm good, Sue, don't get me wrong, but I think it could be a fun sport for sure. So, Cliff, I really appreciate you coming on.
Okay, Cliff.
Thank you so much, everyone.
Wait, you guys, let me ask one more, okay?
Sue's so excited about this.
I've never seen you so active.
I love it.
Yeah, it's intriguing to me.
1 minute,
Can you go and get lessons? I mean, because I would have no idea what I was doing.
Yeah, from Cliff.
Absolutely. We have a clinic called Padel in No Time at the club on weekends and in weeknights. And you can also book an evaluation lesson where I can help place you in the program. You know, we have play with the pro clinics. We have cardio padel, just like cardio tennis, you know, 3 days a week, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday morning, 9 a.m. Those are all great ways to start and jump into the game and learn.
Cliff, this is awesome. I'm going to take one of the clinics and we're going to get out there. We'll see you next week. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, everyone.
Take care. Stand by. Playback
ready. Now, the audio cut of the day.
Well, candidly, I had quite a bit of audio that I could use for cut of the day, but I'm going to narrow it down to one because we're out of time. And I don't know if you heard this yet, but this is just epic. This is, I think this is the former president of Kenya. Okay, the former president of Kenya. You know how we send all this foreign aid all over the planet?
Oh,
well,
yeah.
This is what he said about that.
People the other day crying, oh, I don't know, Trump has removed money. He said he's not giving us any more money. Why are you crying? It's not your government. It's not your country. He has no reason to give you anything. Hey, you don't pay taxes in America. He is appealing to his people. This is a wake-up call for you to say, okay, what are we going to do to help ourselves? Because nobody is going to continue holding out a hand there to give you. It is time for us to use our resources for the right things. We are the ones who are using them for the wrong things.
Oh my God, common sense is taking over the planet. And then this is the DNC, the people that are fighting to be the head of the DNC and what they thought about the election. Why did they lose the election?
Have a show of hands. How many of you believe that racism and misogyny played a role in Vice President Harris's defeat? Okay. That's good. You all pass.
Every one of them. Oh, God bless you, Democrats. You keep going down this route. We love it. We can't wait. You can't use your pronouns now if you work in the federal government. It's a different planet right now. It really is. Have a great weekend. We'll talk on Monday afternoon at 3.
Get more at 971talk.com.